Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back. Hour two at the races. Thanks to Keith Shamblin, and turn our attention to New York. Andy Serling joins us from the New York Racing Association. Good morning.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
Good. Good. I watched on Saturday and kick off to the America's Day at the Races. Going to be a full schedule, kind of wading into the action.
Oh, Saturday. Oh, the show from Fairgrounds. I forgot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, it's nice to, you know, to feature those and, you know, to, you know, for the most part, when it comes to national coverage of the Triple Crown lead up, we don't really, historically, we really have not had, you know, January, February. A lot of, you know, NBC doesn't really swing into action until, you know, much later. So it'll be nice to have access to these kinds of races.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. I think we're planning on covering the other races from Fairgrounds. And, you know, I'm sure we'll have the races from Tampa as well as racers from New York. I'm not sure what else. Oakland. Oh, we'll have Oakland. Right. So we'll have a lot of that stuff. Yeah.
Well, and
we're having Oakland Friday. The Marty Jones is Friday, right?
Yes. Oh, that's so great.
Well, I'm on late, but I don't know who's in there. I glanced the race, but I'm only on early.
Well, we actually.
They normally run the Marty Jones on opening day.
They used to run it on opening weekend on the Monday holiday back when they would start in you know, the previous, you know, they typically it used to start, the second full weekend in January. And, you know, now with the new schedule, they're kind of staggered a little bit.
The Southwest is on President's weekday or something, right?
That would let's see, looking at the calendar, if this is the 22nd, so that makes sense. President's Day is the 15th.
I think Jackie's Warrior is supposed to run there.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how far they'll press the Triple Crown with him. I mean, I can't imagine they seriously think he's a mile and a quarter horse. I think he's a terrific horse, don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan. I think he's great, but not great, but he's really good. But I, you know, it's hard to believe he's going to really be effective in a mile and a quarter. I think he'll be very effective in races like the Woody Stevens and the Alan Jerkins, though. And I think he's terrific. I just, I don't know how far he's going to go.
No, I'm trying to. I have not yet. Usually, I fill in the calendar with the preps, and I have not done that yet. So I don't have my.
Now you're a very busy guy.
I usually have it more at my fingertips. Maybe it's just because the Triple Crown was so out of whack last year. They're just not you know.
I don't know what day of the week it is, much less what
actual date. The action, Andy, in New York, including yesterday, I talked about the upset, the Trombetta horse that comes from, you know, from the back of the pack and rallies up the inside yesterday to close out, you know, the weekend. Tough horse to come up with.
Yeah, first race of the week, I've been an 8-1 shot that lost to a 73-1 shot by a head. And the second to last race of the week, I've been an 8-1 shot that lost to a 37-1 shot. It was impossible. I mean, I guess the lesson from that race, that was very frustrating because I thought that was a golden opportunity, and it was, because it was a 4-5 that I rightfully felt was a horrible, horrible bet, a great bet against. I mean, I guess in retrospect, in a small field, felt like the one I could have had a tiny exact as a favor, but it was a tough horse to have. But yeah, I mean, that was, you know, a good opportunity to bet against the favorite in there who, you know, if you drew a line through her last race, she was a contender, but nothing more. And her last race was an aberrant race and a wet track. And the horse who beat her came back and ran significantly worse, and also losing at a short price in a race on paper she couldn't lose. And it just felt like, you know, taking a super short price on a horse that had everything her own way in a wet track, odd race, sort of a match race, as it turned out. It was a good opportunity to bet against her, but unfortunately, the winner was, at least for me, a little hard to make. But hey, congrats to Mike, and, you know, they made the right choice running there. I mean, it's funny, you know, that race was a slow race, and not surprisingly, it got a slow big, got a 78 big. I don't think she was going to win if it would run that quickly. You know, there was an allowance earlier in the day. Let me take this call. Who's gotten so good for Jimmy Ferraro. You know, she won with like a 95 buyer, and both the second and third horses got 86s. Neither one of them could have won the Interborough. You know, you don't know that going in, but it turned out that was a significantly tougher race. Now, to be fair, I don't think the purses were that significantly different, but I guess the difference is black tight.
Well, and Trombetta himself, you know, basically moved her up for that spot instead of staying home at Laurel and facing.
Well, Hello Beautiful, obviously, with six furlongs, yeah, was pretty much unbeatable in that race at Laurel. And so Mike figured, if I'm going to take a shot, I might as well take a shot at seven against a field that, you know, has sort of one figure, one horse, and the rest of it's very much open.
Exactly, and it worked out.
Mike's no dope.
No. Well, and you know, it's interesting too. I you know, I can fold in from Saturday in the Franklin Square too. Had the longest shot.
That was a New York Red Race.
Right. The Kimmel Secret Love. At 13-1, you know what we should talk about too from Saturday, the opportunity that the Pick Five carryover produced.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was a hittable sequence, but you couldn't have hit it for small money. You know, I mean, all the more horses that I had, you know, somewhere in my selections, but I think you had to, you know, you had to play it right. I mean, to me, the only way I could have done it is if I went, you know, with three A's in three of the races, two A's in the fourth leg, and you know, I would have used the winner of the third race to C, but tough to do that for under $300. And, you know, so it's a question how much money you put in. It was halvable for sure at 7,100. It paid three times the parlay almost. Probably was 2,400 and change. And it was also a good example of how, you know, people think, oh, there's short prices in there, it's not going to pay anything. And that's, you know, that's always just an indefensibly dumb way to look at it. You play and you hope for the best. And, you know, we saw relatively logical horses win the first two legs. But then suddenly that, you know, the two biggest singles in the sequence lost. One was that Gargan horse, the 3-5, and the other one was the favorite, I think, was 3-5 in the fourth race. You know, I mean, it was hittable for me because I thought Lobster was the right other horse, but, you know, it's sort of not easy to get there necessarily, and I don't think it was the second likeliest winner of that race, particularly on paper. And, I mean, the, you know, one of the things that made that sequence difficult, I think, for people to play was the last leg. I mean, I happen to have liked the winner, liked under quotation marks the winner, but I liked is just the horse I happened to put on top in a race where five or six of them could easily have won that race, very usable. So I wouldn't, just as there are some races where I feel like my third pick could have been my first pick, that my first pick could have been my third or fourth pick in that race. It just happened to go that way. But it was a playable. It was a hard sequence, but if you had the bankroll or you went in with friends or something and played it, you could have hit it.
Well, and, you know, I suppose part of the key with Accelerator in that third leg, you know, goes off at a little over 7-1. And, of course, the whole thing was a little complicated by the wet weather and the seal.
The thing for me about the third leg was a five-course field, and I just, didn't trust the favorite. I well understood that the favorite was very much the likeliest winner.
Sure.
Very much. But something about that horse just didn't. That horse's last race, the 76 Fig, could have been 10 points high. It just seems like some of those performances haven't been repeated. And just thought that was a vulnerable type horse. And, yeah, you throw in the wet track, and it gums the whole thing up. The problem was, you know, the one wasn't any more necessarily likely to win than any of three horses in there. You know, it was sort of the 6 and 4, and then, you know, figure what you want to do with the other three. I unfortunately guessed with one that ran fourth. On top, because I thought they were both vulnerable at 4 and 6. But, you know, I mean, you have to go in there and you have to get it as C's. And I think you have to find a way to get the other four as A's. I mean, three of the four were very usable A's, you know, especially if you went three deep and each one as A's. And then you had to like Lobster a little bit. I happened to like Lobster a little bit. That was probably the one opinion you need to have in the sequence to hit it, you know. The rest might have fallen in line. But once again, they're only going to fall in line if you're putting enough money in. You can't put, you know, $64 or $72 into the sequence and somehow manage to get all those horses as A's and the third winner is, you know, as a C and get it home. It's very hard. You know, it's a bankroll situation. I don't think there's any single winner in the sequence and you go, I can't believe that horse won.
Right.
But doesn't mean it's easy to get them all the same ticket, even if you had opinions like I did, which were reasonably good, you know. But, you know, and I'm not, it's not like it was easy to really have a strong opinion on the third winner, you know.
No.
That horse did come out of a slow maiden race. Having said that, the horse probably moved a little soon in that race and still managed to win. But there was also a horse in the race that got left that would have won the race if that didn't happen. So there were also mitigating circumstances. It's just tricky, you know. It's a lot, you know. It's been interesting, you know, looking at some of the races because, for instance, was that Saturday?
Yes.
Saturday was it Saturday or Friday? I mean, it was Friday. One of the days, I think it was Friday, it seemed like speed was very hard to close. No, it was Friday. It wasn't the wet track day. Very hard to make up considerable ground. And I don't know that it was a speed track as much as it was closers for whatever reason seemingly being hindered. And I think one of the possibilities that people believe, and I give it some credence, I don't feel as strongly about it as some others, doesn't make me right and I'm wrong, that's for sure, but it's the notion of kickback. I think kickback is dramatically overrated. I think as horses get experience, they run through kickback. Maybe first-time starters, you know, I could see that, or second-time starter, but in general, you've been around a while, blah, blah, blah. But what occurred to me later in doing the track trends, because I do the track trends every day, you see the wind, and the wind may vary. It may be very low. It may be 3 to 4 degrees, I mean, miles per hour. It might be 15 to 20 miles per hour. But it's usually northeast, sometimes southeast, occasionally north to southwest, you're sort of moving around. Friday was about 15 to 20, somewhere in there, directly west. I almost never see that. And interestingly enough, Sunday and Monday were directly east, for whatever that's worth. But I wondered, because of the sort of weird circumstances, and I don't know if it's the case, but it just, you have to consider anything, everything, is that maybe the west, you know, the relatively strong direct west winds had something to do with hindering closers. I don't know. Seems like a possibility. It's somewhat of an unusual circumstance. So maybe that was the case. And, you know, it's just hard because there's that odd weekend of the 18th, 19th, and 20th of December where the 17th was canceled because we had the big snowstorm and the night of the 16th, right? So we ran the 18th, and the 18th is a really funny day because I could find individual races on the 18th where if you took them in isolation, you could make a good, strong case the rail was dead. I'll give you a horse that was on the rail in one of those races, Mills, won yesterday. The horse that ran second to Brass Ring, the big price that won the last race, I think on Saturday, that horse on the rail. And I think there's some others. Horses that just evaporated on the rail. I'll give you another one. The Linda Rice horse, Beautiful Karen, evaporated. On the rail, but drifted out, to be fair. But there were races where, there were also races where I would tell you, like the last winner, that promising horse for Bob LaPenta, Nikki the Best, that horse, he'll tell you it's a gold rail. Or certainly the rail was good, right? Or Sunshine on the Rail, and there's other races like that too. And then when you couple with the 19th and 20th, where it looked like a gold rail, you're going to say, well, maybe the 18th was a gold rail. But no, maybe. So it's like I'm confused. I'm baffled. Unlike some crazy people, I don't think that the track is going out and changing the track between races. I don't know what's going on. I just see the result. I don't know why it's happening. I'm not sure I care. I mean, I'd like to know exactly if I could find out, but I don't know.
Sure.
And then, you know, the 19th to 20th, and David Aragona, whose opinion I respect as much as anyone looking at it, you know, was making some cases that maybe those gold rails, the 19th and 20th, aren't as strong as we thought. But there are examples, like a Chateau who was on the rail, who came back and ran very well yesterday in winning. Well, yeah, but how about the horse that won the race, that I forget his name, he was in the race with Chateau, he's the favorite. He came up the rail and angled out in the stretch, and yesterday he was, you know, he got a normal trip and he didn't run at all. I don't know. There's examples and counterexamples. And I think it's tricky with biases. I remember there was a day, I think a week ago, 2 weeks ago, it's hard to remember when. And I talked about it in the track trends, where it really looked like a speed track, yet looking at the buyer figs for the winners, none of them really overperformed. So if horses are being really helped by a rail, they rate to be running significantly better figures, or at least better figures than you would expect, right? Just as if a horse is running against it, they should be running worse. And that day didn't really back it up. Yet, one of the horses that closed from way back in that race was a Dave Donk horse that came back this weekend and won and improved its buyer figure 13 points. So maybe it really was helping speed. You know, I don't know. Or maybe it was hindering closers and not really helping speed. It looked like it was helping speed, but it was actually hindering closers. I don't know. I don't have the absolute answer to this. Nobody has an absolute. It's about looking at biases and trying to figure out. And I think we've been presented this year so far with some interesting examples. And I find sort of fascinating. Doesn't mean I have the answers to it. You know, and the last thing you want to do is be overly hasty about declaring biases. I don't do it. You know, you look at yesterday. The first two races, if you took them in isolation, I commented this, would tell you it's a big outside track. They were first two races, and they were sort of logical results, and they weren't particularly strong fields, and you don't want to make those determinations. And then, you know, in the third race, a heavy favorite goes out and wires the field inside. So, you know, if you look at that in isolation, you say, oh, it's a speedy track. Well, that was a 3-5 shot. You know, it's hard. You have to look at the totality of it. And I think maybe what we're seeing this year more than other years is, I wonder if speed is only appears to be being helped by the fact that closers are being hindered. So it's not a speed track, it's an anti-closers track. And I know that sounds like the same thing, but I think there's a subtle difference, at the very least.
I'm just putting, as we talk, I just put up a tweet with the link to the track trends section, because you know, this is one of those things that, you know, unless you poke around the website sometimes, or unless you're reminded about the access to it, you might not be aware, and you go through the notations.
I don't go back, because I don't really think it's fair to ask people to do those and edit those. You know, like, should I be going back about the 1920 and say, hey, maybe these rails aren't as strong? Yeah, maybe. I don't know. You know, I'd like to think that people look at them, and I'd like to think that everybody's a little bit cynical, right? You know, everybody looks at everything and says, okay, this is Annie's opinion. Let me look at it myself a little bit. And you see it, you know, and you know, none of this stuff is written in stone, right? It's all just it does feel, I would argue the 1920th that I do think the rail was very much the place to be, but you know, there are some examples where horses have, you know, come back. And then again, you know, there's that Rick Schatzberg horse that got, I forget, Ruby's in Time, got a huge figure coming up the rail. Well, she came back and she didn't get the right trip, but she didn't run at all. Now, some people tell you she bounced. I don't believe in that stuff. I think it was different circumstances. I do think she was helped by the rail. But you know, I don't know. Different people have different views of looking at races, and that's, you know, that's what makes the racing world go round.
Andy, how? And I know this is a, you know, this is a broad canvas, but you know, for players that are learning and that don't necessarily have, you know, immediate understanding of what the results or what the charts or even watching replays, that they won't necessarily you know, seize on this information. How does a developing player get more acclimated to this, and you know, what can they look for, and how does it, you know, how can they learn?
I would go back to what I've always said, which is there's never any substitution for watching as many races as you can, because I feel that watching races, actually watching them, taking a broad view of them, gives you an understanding of how races are run. It just sort of gets into your brain, you know, what kind of moves are effective. You know, I'll give you an interesting example of a move. The horse I bet in the feature yesterday that ran second. A lot of people say of the race, well, if Manny Franco had just stayed inside, he could have gotten a clear run like the winner did, and he would have won. Maybe he would have, maybe he wouldn't have. Manny Franco was trying to make the right move, because the right move is to sit out inside of horses and angle out to run. And that's the way horses in general accelerate. They accelerate getting outside. You think about turf horses in general, right? Save ground, angle out, get in the clear, make your run. That's just sort of the nature of the way horses run. So Manny got a bit unlucky. And in result, you said, well, look at the way the winner did and everything. Well, I don't know. The winner managed to get her momentum and did it up inside. I'm not convinced the one would have gotten her momentum the same way. And, you know, I actually saw Manny on the way out, and we were talking about it, and he agreed. You know, I said, listen, he knew I bet the horse, he knew I picked the horse, so he felt bad. But I said, you try to do the right thing, and it doesn't always work out, you know? I mean, you can't. So you watch races. Horses don't accelerate inside the same as they accelerate when they angle out and make their runs. That's just a fact. Watch races, you know? Horses much more frequently, you know, sort of hang towards the inside, and they accelerate outside. I think it's a herd thing. I talked to Richie Migliori about this. And doesn't mean there are some rail runners, you know? Street Sense was a rail runner. There are some horses that they're lug-in type horses, and they don't get comfortable until they get inside, right? But in general, you want to try to angle out. You know, I used to watch horses spin their wheels inside and wonder why, you know, they're saving ground, right? The shortest way of the winner, the winner circle, right, is to stay inside. Yet horses don't often accelerate. I don't know why exactly. I'm not exactly sure. But I know that's the way it works. So I think, you know, you want to determine racing, you watch races and see what works and what doesn't work. And, I mean, horses may have different inclinations, but in general, they're herd animals, right? They like to run outside of each other. You know, watch stretch duels. Most of the momentum is on the outside. As far as biases, I don't know. I think it comes from watching a lot of races. I can't tell you why, but I feel like I can pretty quickly pick up if there's an inside speed, inside type track, pretty quickly. I think it just comes to the fact that I've been watching races for 40-plus years and thinking about them a lot. You know, most people don't have the time or the inclination to spend their lives doing that the way I have. But I think I'm being involved in the game, watching races and thinking about them. You know, there's no substitute for anything you do for giving it thought and having an open mind, you know.
I'm going to, it's funny because I was fixing some old links and doing some editing on the website, on our website you know, sort of industry links. And one of the links I had on there, Andy, was the Trips and Traps. And they're still up on the NIRA YouTube channel.
Most of the horses have run back, though, by now.
That was so instructive. And even now, I mean, to listen to, you know, you and Eric, and, you know, whoever, you know, was the partner, at different times.
Richie and I did it for quite a while.
Richie, absolutely. And in fact, Richie brought it up the other day when we talked. That was so helpful because if people have a point of reference and they see, you know, there's some instruction there that is saying, you know, here's an example of a horse that took advantage of a bias and, you know, is going to be a short price coming back. And this is the kind of opportunity you take to bet against.
Yeah, I missed Trips and Traps.
It was great. And of course, you still do some of that with Talking Horses, but you know the time constraint makes it, you know, you still point out that stuff when you have opportunities running replays.
Trips and Traps is one of the first things I instituted when I came to NYRA. Eric and I started doing it right after I started work. I remember we were taping on that old outdoor set that used to be up by the paddock at Belmont.
Yeah, what is that? Here's something I just pulled up from September of 2013.
Been a while since we've done it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's 5 years.
Yeah.
It's 5 years.
Five years ago, I was down in Florida with Gabby.
Well.
Living in the Hampton Inn and going to the mall every day. I hung out at the mall that winter. My last winter at the mall. I always liked that mall to the Scotch Tape Store in the old Saturday Night Live.
Scotch Tape Store. with Aykroyd working behind the counter. It's so great. You know what I missed from over there was the great service at the Steak and Shake across the street.
That was unbelievable, that place. That place was unbelievable. It was next to the Hampton Inn, and there were nights where I didn't feel like, you know, going somewhere for dinner. So occasionally, like once a week or so, I'd go there. I mean, you could sit in there waiting for like a burger and a thing of fries for like 40 minutes. And there were like six people there. Craziest place, right?
The world's worst service, and it because I'd stayed there a couple different times, and in that Hampton, and same
right?
thing. And I like Steak and Shake, but forget it. You were investing at least 25 minutes.
You could go there and get it in 5, but you could also wait like 40 minutes and not get it at all.
Exactly.
I finally stormed out. I think once after something terminal
exactly.
wait, and there was nobody there. Went out and I never went back. I used to go a couple times a week to that steakhouse in the mall by Gulfstream.
Sure.
I get my work done, you know, the preliminary stuff, and at like 8:30 or something, I'd walk over there with my form, and there was never anybody there, and I'd sit by myself at the bar, and you know, with my form and Danny having the race, whatever day we had drawn that day. And have some lamb chops and a couple of glasses of wine or something. And it was great because there was never anyone there. I remember asking the bartender once, I said, it was a busy night. I said, go in there, you know, 8:39. And she looked at me and said, it's never busy. Like, that was the dumbest question. You know, the way I look at people when they ask me these ridiculous questions on Twitter.
Well, I think that's gone now.
Is it?
I think so.
Not surprised.
I think so. It's yeah.
It was next to this, I think it was right. You walked in; it was very close. It was like 5 minutes to walk there.
I never had to worry about waiting. No.
I could order. I could sit at the bar, have a couple of glasses of wine, have something to eat, and it was quicker than going down to this.
Going to Steak and Shake.
Waiting for your food.
Oh my God! Too funny.
Anyway, we're probably done. I should be. You can let. I can go free now, right?
More or less. I haven't looked ahead yet this week. Andy Simoff, thank you. Three Forks. I thought it was called Forks, and Andy Simoff just texted and said Three Forks, and it is gone.
Oh, that was the name of the place.
Yes, yes. I can see. I can even see the logo up on the wall. Yeah. well, Andy, this weekend, looking ahead, the Jazzle on Saturday, the Busanda on Sunday, and moving toward the Withers, February 6th, the next big three-year-old date.
Okay. Was that the following week or 2 weeks?
Yes, in 2 weeks for those that are...
Well, we're all worked up for the race formerly known as the Dawn being run this weekend.
Well, it...
I'm doing a preview video for it Thursday morning if you want to get really excited.
All right, we'll direct people, and you may not know the answer to this. When will we start seeing some cross country?
That's right. You should ask Joe Longo. That's his job.
I will. I'll text. I'll send Joe a note. I'm curious. I would think
yeah,
with the
text Joe. Ask him. Yeah,
I will.
Yeah,
I will.
I mean, he would know. I would assume he would know, but I'm not the right person to ask.
No, I would think sooner than later.
It's still a valuable question. I mean, I would assume that we would do something with the shows, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's getting to be that time of year. Well, and I'm just going
to give you a reason to call Joe, just contact Joe, and I know that's always one of your favorite things to do.
I will. I will do that, and we will report back for the 2021 cross-country pick fives, and Andy, we'll look forward to Friday, opening day in Oaklawn, and some coverage. America's Day.
Yeah, we're on Saturday and Sunday this weekend.
Excellent.
I'm not in on Sunday, and I think after that we're on most Saturday and Sunday. I think there's one or two weekends we might be just on Saturday, but on mostly Saturday and Sunday throughout the winter until we start doing it full time in April.
Nice. All right, so
there'll really be a lot of our racing because in March, where we race only 3 days a week, so and through the Memorial, so it's like 5 or 6 weeks we race only 3 days a week. For all intents and purposes, and I think this Saturday, I know I'm doing some races from Tampa and Oaklawn, and I think they're showing some fairgrounds late. I'm like I said, I'm on the first part of Friday, and the first part of Saturday.
Well, it's still very welcome, and got off to a good start with the fairgrounds action.
A crazily bad race, that LeCompte. I have no idea why the winner paid $940 in that Mandaloon race horse. Three of five?
Yep.
Why were they perceptively different prices, those horses? I thought they'd be the same price. Seven to five, somewhere. What were they so excited about that Mandaloon for? He ran two, sort of okay figs with very good trips in both of his races. I have no idea why people went crazy. And he was stretching out for the first time, whereas the one who was controlling speed had only run route races and he'd run, earlier in his career faster, as fast, if not faster, figs. That was nuts.
I agree. I didn't.
I bet the winner. I have no idea how that horse paid $940.
I'm with you. I
don't think it was a good pick. I just think it was bad betting by people in that race.
Your man Amos is firing on all cylinders down there. Have you been following him?
Is following like another word for euphemism for stalk? No.
No, you just are you watching what he's doing down there? He had another terrific performer yesterday. That zoom up stretched out beautifully.
I tell you, he's a legend.
He is a legend, that's for sure. Amos.
Okay.
I'm Andy, done. I appreciate it. That was fun. I for those that didn't hear or the haven't seen it yet, I put up the link to that Track Trends, which is...
Thank you. I'm going.
Not at all. The people should know that that kind of thing is available on the website and how to take advantage of it. You get a read on days and, then watch for the horses... when opportunities arise, when there's extremes, most often that's how you take advantage. are in this game as a horse player, whether there's extremely, when you're looking at handicapping, if there's an extreme pace scenario, if there's an extreme slow pace scenario, when there's been an extreme in one direction or another, and then when the horses come back out of those circumstances, those are the best opportunities for betting success. Let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back with Dr. Stephen Allday, Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn, and got two-plus subjects for Dr. Allday, one involving horses of advancing age. And Andy mentioned Mills coming back and winning at the age of 11. We'll let Steve talk about, you know, the care and maintenance of, you know, older horses. And, you know, how do you discern? I mean, as a horse's performance level, you know, starts to diminish. But obviously he's still competitive. He's able to win for 8 and 10. So I'm curious. I want Steve to advise how a racetrack practitioner views that. And then the Bowie's hero story, very sad. The challenges of a laminitis diagnosis and or, you know, the kinds of diagnoses that have the threat of laminitis involved. Dr. Stephen Allday joins us next. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM
all
Radio.
All day, all night, all day, all night, all day, all night, all night. What the fuck?
We're back, and about 15 to the top of the hour, I do see that... I do see that it's Ed DeRosa's birthday, so he'll be with us tomorrow, so I'll get out ahead of it and wish Ed a happy birthday. Remind me tomorrow to wish Ed a happy birthday. As I mentioned, you know, I thought that there were immediately, as I was going through things yesterday and you know, putting together the show, I said I got to reach out to Dr. Allday because between the 11-year-old winning, and it's been a while since we've talked about horses of advanced age, and then the Laminitis claiming Bowie's Hero. I said, well, here's a great way to have our first horse health today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn. Dr. Stephen Allday, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Happy, healthy to you and the girls and the staff.
Thank you. I'll let them know.
Yeah. Steve, I had to touch base with you because the Laminitis story that that happened fairly quickly, too. Bowie's Hero and ended up with an infection. They treat the infection, and then things started to slide. Had been, you know, some good days, some bad days, and then, you know, it all gets away. And it made me think to let you, you know, kind of just riff on the different threats of leg and extremity and hoof issues that can become a laminitis case.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting subject because it is so diverse. It is kind of a little bit mind-boggling and somewhat, it can be a bit scary. Laminitis can be brought on literally from anything from a very, very difficult trip, like, you know, trailer ride, truck ride, this sort of thing, to trimming a horse too close, too short. And, you know, a lot of times what can happen is when a horse succumbs to or has an injury to one limb, meaning like a fracture, you know, a devastating or catastrophic type breakdown, where they have to have, you know, screws or implements put or plates into the opposite limb, they can have laminitis from that. They can get it from infections, from pneumonia. I mean, it is extremely diverse. But the thing that you have to realize is that it can occur from this, and yet take all the means that you can to try to prevent it. Because, like I always say, you know, it's kind of like my credo is that, you know, preventative medicine is a lot more rewarding and a lot more. It's certainly, you know, better for the horse in the long run than restorative medicine, because a lot of times, you know, you can fix the problem. You know, let's say if it's a cannon fracture or pneumonia, this sort of thing, but if they succumb to the laminitis, then you lose the war, essentially. So you might win the battle, but you lose the war. In this horse's case, apparently he had an infection from what, you know, I didn't get a chance to look up any details about him because I started over in Lexington early, and now I'm back over in the north side of Louisville at Skylight Training Center working on horses. So, but. What, you know, I don't want to digress too much. Let's just stick to the point.
Sure.
Is that essentially, you know, this horse must have had an infection that got really, really out of hand. And the problem you end up having with an infection that gets really, really creates a lot of systemic release of endotoxins, this sort of thing, is either like from pneumonia or let's say like, you know, maybe it could be something simple, like just like, you know, cellulitis, whatever. But if it gets out of hand and it gets to where it's producing a bunch of endotoxins, the endotoxins can basically stimulate or start off the cascade, which creates, you know, the inflammation in the lamina and the feet, mainly front feet, but it can occur in all four, as we've discussed in the past. And what you end up doing is, you know, you've got to be careful of, you know, any type of infection or anything that's going to essentially, like pneumonias and or pleurisy and or, you know, anything that can create an endotoxemia, because this can end up resulting in laminitis in the long run. So what you got to do is, you know, if you have anything that you suspect, horse basically has, like, you know, a local infection, then all of a sudden you get some heat in the feet, then this can be a sequela to the infection. So you got to get on it and get aggressive and get it taken care of right away so you don't get set back and have this problem, you know, and then eventually pay the price. Horses that have pre-existing laminitic episodes are obviously predisposed to having further ones down the road. That's something that has to be on the, kind of like on the radar, if you've got a horse that you know has had an episode, so you don't have to succumb to it eventually. You know, a lot of times mares will get it, let's say, from a retained placenta, you know, because that creates quite a bit of endotoxemia, you know, in the uterus. And essentially, so it's you know, something you got to watch out this time of year because we're into foaling season, this sort of thing. The laminitis has rarely ever occurred much in foals. We hardly ever see it in foals, so that's something probably that's beneficial in the long run. But bottom line is that, you know, it's something that you got to stay ahead of, be aware of, and essentially, you know, not let it get the best of you. In this case, it must, the infection must have gotten, you know, a pretty good setup, pretty good housekeeping, and gotten ahead, and then had a huge release of endotoxin, and his horse got set back. Because you may get the infection under control, but the endotoxemia has already started to cascade to where there's what they call arteriovenous shunting, which stops blood flow to the feet, and that's what creates the actual laminitic episode. And once that occurs, you know, that itself has to be addressed along with all the other, you know, secondary problems that can go with it, obviously, or the things that cause it to start with. So, you know, bottom line is, you know, be preventative, stay ahead of things before the problems occur, and get these things taken care of before, you know, you pay the ultimate price, which essentially is, you know, the potential for a laminitic episode. That, you know, can end up, you know, creating such a release, you know, or a loss of the support tissue in the foot that they end up rotating and or dropping out. And so, therefore, they eventually, you know, have to be euthanized. And that probably was the case here as I'm reading it.
Two follow-ups as I listen. Number one, is there a certain kind of a horse that may be more susceptible to laminitic episode than others, whether it's the types with thin, we hear about the thin hoof walls that need glue on shoes, you know, horses, I mean, in terms of their conformation, is there, you know, a pre-existing conditions, as we've all come to hear so often in regard to pandemic, is there a horse that might be more susceptible to the potential to become laminitic?
Not in my experience, Steve. I mean, laminitis can occur in a horse that's club-footed, a horse that's good-footed, a horse that's sand-walled, a horse that's had glue on, a horse that's had quarter cracks, a horse that has no problems whatsoever. It's just the right episode and the right cascade of sequences and happenstance that occurs in the right, you know, and literally the wrong time, you know, is what it comes down to. I mean, you know, I mean, I've seen horses get on a truck, look perfect, came out of a race great, the whole bit, sent them to the farm, everything looked like it's going to be fine, step off the truck and have laminitis. What happened on the trip? I don't know. The guy basically picked the roughest road he could find. Hard to say. Seen horses go out and, you know, saddle horses and have a, you know, go out and have an extended period of time over really, really, really hard ground and or asphalt, come back, feet start really pounding, boom, go into laminitis. Not really sure, you know, why certain ones. It just, you know, that if it was something in their diet that day, the combination of the environment, the pounding, and or you name it. But, you know, just one at a time, and it sets up, and it starts the cascade, or it starts the thing, the ball, you know, the snowball rolling down the hill in the snowstorm. Essentially, it's on its way. And, you know, you've got to, the quicker you get on top of it and recognize it and start treating it, you know, accordingly, the better off you are in the long run. But unfortunately, like I said, early and aggressive treatment and or prevention, if you can, is obviously going to be the best. And, you know, how do you prevent it? Well, good question. I mean, you know, I've seen the perfect situation, you know, that looked like wouldn't be a big deal. I mean, something as simple as a horse with a foot abscess, and they got off that foot, and all of a sudden, you know, it just got out of hand, and boom, they're laminitic on the opposite supporting foot because they wouldn't bear weight on the one that's got the abscess. Now, you know, I mean, if you could have prevented the abscess, obviously it wouldn't have occurred. But, you know, how do you do that? Good question. Not sure. Not really sure how you'd answer that. Not sure anybody would know how to prevent it. But, you know, the one thing I can tell you is the quicker you can get on it, the better off you're going to be as far as that's concerned.
We haven't discussed, we haven't really had a laminitis conversation in a few years. And, of course, if we go back to the era associated after Barbaro's death, you know, there had been, you know, a lot of discussion about advances. I mean, have you know, in your career, have you seen progress on this topic? Are we fighting back more successfully? You know, there was the painter circumstance as well. I mean, do you sense that vets are winning more fights against laminitis than they used to?
Great question. I would have said up until, I think we were a little bit in the dark, and maybe up until maybe the 70s or 80s, I think we got a better hold on it when people, you know, like Dr. Hood at Texas A&M and a number of people, you know, started understanding, you know, what occurred and how it occurred and, you know, what was actually going on. So we could probably use medications, you know, to try to, you know, get ahead of it quicker once it started, you know, the cascade started. However, you know, have I seen a great deal of change since the 80s or 90s? No, not really. Maybe in some certain aspects of shoeing to help support the cough and moan a little better. I think, you know, I use the soft ride boots quite a bit with the sole support and or frog support, you know, early on myself. Obviously, you know, certain medications seem to be, you know, anti-endotoxemic like Banamine. Obviously, the advent of Banamine helps a great deal. Anti-inflammatories, certain drugs, phenoxybenzamine, and, of course, you know, acepromazine, because it's an alpha blockade to stop or slow down what they call the arterial venous shunning, so you get better circulation to the foot so you don't starve the lamina. And the starving the lamina is what basically creates the rotation or the release of the supportive tissue around the coffin bone. So that's kind of like, you know, that's the ultimate problem you have, and that's the ultimate demise that occurs, is that when this occurs so, you know, so rapidly and so efficiently and so, you know, so tremendously that you can't stop the coffin bone from rotating through the feet or through the sole itself. So, you know, yeah, you know, to a point, I think we got better up until the 80s, early 90s, and I think we've been a little bit, we're still up against the wall a bit. Obviously, you know, my whole, you know, attitude and focus would be on prevention, so I do everything I can routinely to try to stay ahead. You know, I mean, I, you know, like I said, I'm a Murphy's Law guy. If I think there's a chance of something bad that can happen, I try to think it out. Like, you know, you have to kind of almost have a little bit of a crystal ball type situation where you have to stay ahead of it that way. But that's essentially what you have to do, is you got, you know, stay on the preventive side, stay ahead of it before it becomes a problem. So, you know, if you can predict or at least stay ahead of the predictable outcome or consequences, then the better off you are in the long run, essentially, Steve.
Well, and Steve, I'm going to sort of spring this on you, and I should have thought this morning when I ran the subjects by you, but you just said something when it came to shoeing that occurs to me to have you pay some tribute to Ray Amato Jr., who you undoubtedly spent many, many mornings around at the Pletcher Barn.
Well, you know, that's a tough subject. Last Thursday morning, this past Thursday, I was in, I was at Palm Beach Downs, and I've been friends with Ray Amato Sr. since 1987. I met him in 1987 at Belmont Park, and you know, he's, you know, one of the godfathers of the Ferrier era. From you know, the guy's worked in California. He worked for Pancho Martin, a bunch of Hall of Famers. Future Hall of Famers. He shot for Bobby Frankel. He shot for Todd when he first started. It just, you know, I can't say enough about him. I worked directly with Ray in some outfits that I worked at Belmont when I was there, and, you know, over the years as I've gone in and out. But Ray told me last Thursday morning that Ray told me this morning that he says he wants to go to hospice and he just can't take it anymore. And ironically enough, that night he passed away, so... You know, yeah, he was a really good friend, and I think the world of those guys. Ray Sr. is, you know, as close, I've got probably as close a blacksmith's relationship with him as I do. He's not just a blacksmith, he's a great guy and a really good friend. And, you know, and Ray Jr. was the same way, and we used to go to dinner sometimes and eat, and, you know, it's difficult for me to talk about him without getting a little getting a little upset. So, but I can tell you this much. I mean, they're class acts. He was a great guy, and, you know, he's a pleasure to work with, and he always had a smile on his face, and he was always easy. Never a cross word, never a problem with Ray at any point in my career. So, you know, will be missed. He was loved, but he will be missed.
The outpouring of contemporaries, because he was in his early 50s, and they're just the circle of horsemen, Kentucky, New York, Florida, it's obvious from everybody. And, of course, his father, the longevity, and one of the real legends of the fairing business. And it's just very, very tough to say goodbye to Ray Amato Jr. I didn't mean to throw that at you, but I knew the connection was obvious. Let's talk about a cheery subject and something that we can admire, and that's an older horse, Steve. At the age of 11 yesterday, Mills, the son of a horse that you worked on, undoubtedly, any given Saturday, here's an 11-year-old that won again yesterday, and not only won, I mean, he won really well. His 10th career win in 78 starts, another 29 board placements. And, you know, he's running for 12, 10, 8. He's running 60 and 70 buyers. Steve, how do horsemen and vets make determinations about a horse getting to this age, 9, 10, 11, and, you know, obviously still competitive at a level? It's a tough one. I see people, you know, complaining, give him a home and he's done enough. But, well, he's obviously still a racehorse.
Well, no doubt. I mean, listen, if they still love it and they still want to go do it and train every day and they're eating good and they're clean legged and they're sound, you know, there's really no reason not to let them do it. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that racehorses were born and bred to be racehorses. So let them be what they want to be. And until they basically can't be what they want to be, you know, I think it's no different than, you know, professional athletes that are basketball players or whatever it is that they do. You know, I think they'll let you know when it's time that they don't want to do it anymore. And obviously this horse hasn't let them know that yet. And he's justified it by essentially, you know, putting himself in the winner's circle. So, you know, they with standard breeds, they had a mandatory retirement. And standard breeds obviously don't get the wear and tear and the problems that, you know, thoroughbreds do. And they don't nearly get, you know, I mean, they just don't get the pounding. They get a lot more starts per annum, per year. But, you know, they'll race until they're 14 and they have to stop. Well, thoroughbreds don't have a retirement date. So, you know, and you got to remember now, certain horses just have that longevity factor. I mean, you remember John Henry. Everybody remembers John Henry. I mean, he won a grade one at the age of 9. Now, you know, that's saying something. I mean, and he wanted to go do it. He still acted the same and showed, you know, the parts of the puzzle. When they finally, you know, when he started having some issues with some areas, you know, they basically pulled the plug. It was time, you know, he let them know. And he showed you that it was time, you know, not to do it anymore. But until then, you know, he was still ready to go out and run against the best and win against the best. So, therefore, you know, at the level, that, as long as you're not running them over their head and they're not hurting themselves out there trying, I'd say, you know, let them do their job. Because I think most horses like their job. They like to have a job. They like doing their job, and they like having something to do. So, you know, until then, you know, and me, I always err on the side of caution. So, I mean, if they show you a reason not to do it, pull the plug. But if they show you a reason that they can do it, you know, give them a chance. End of story.
I brought this up with you before about, you know, horses, you know, getting to be an older, you know, reaching advanced ages. Arthritis comes up. You know, what challenges are there in an older horse, and what, you know, what begins to show a reduced capacity to compete, and how much of it sometimes is horses souring. I mean, if that's something to watch for versus just, you know, a deterioration of talent level.
Well, the deterioration of talent probably has to do with physical deficits, Steve-O. And the reason why is that, you know, obviously, you know, my area of expertise is, you know, osteoarthritis, degenerative joint disease, because, you know, it's what I've done since my whole career. And I focused a lot on that. You know, a tremendous, you know, obviously focus, we have a lot of focus radiographically on the advent due to conformation and or wear and tear due to, like, their jobs, meaning they go out and pound every day. But the bottom line is that when you lose, you know, a certain amount of cartilage, and this is, you know, exhibits itself in the form of osteoarthritis. And osteoarthritis is the clinical symptoms that you get from degenerative joint disease. And when it gets down to a point when there's such a tremendous loss of cartilage or MCAP cartilage in the moving joints, fetlocks, Kaufman, carpus or knees, stifle, hocks, hind fetlocks, and or cannons. Bottom line is that these things will start showing you a deficit in gait, a profile and or a capsulitis or inflammation associated with that joint, enlargement and increased fluid in those joints, a decreased range of motion, meaning that if you flex them, this sort of thing, they show you, you know, quite a bit of, you know, resistance and or pain on flexion. And they show you a deficit while out training and or riding and or jogging when you evaluate them with no weight on their back. And as these things occur, with their normal senility and or aging changes, all mammals that have diarthrodial or synovial joints essentially will have deterioration to some extent. It happens to people. It happens to your cat or dog. It happens to your horse. It happens to every living mammal. So the bottom line is that, you know, every horse, every animal, every person's a little different. You know, you may be in a lot better shape for your age than I am, or, you know, joint-wise. I may be better than you. It depends on how you have taken care of yourself, you know, the activities that you've done, the functions, things like this you've done, and or if you bend or you know, put a lot of wear and tear, or essentially a lot of it has to do with your conformation and the way you're made. You know, if you're bow-legged, if you're a little bit pigeon-toed, things like this, this puts pressure in areas, you know, that wouldn't necessarily do that. Same thing with a horse.
Yep.
And so therefore, the deficits of a horse is made perfectly, and, you know, he's got really healthy joints, and he's still able to function. He doesn't show you deficit enlargement and or the clinical symptoms of arthritis leading to degenerative joint disease or deterioration of these joints. Therefore, they can still keep doing their jobs until these things occur. Obviously, that could be the case with Mills. So bottom line is, when they can still function and they don't have that deterioration, they can still go out and don't show you a deficit and or problem, then they should still probably be able to perform. But if they start showing you enlargement and or deficits and or, you know, the inability, or then they'll show you the attitude. When they're uncomfortable, they, after a while, they don't want to do their job anymore. And if they don't want to do their job, something's bothering them. Horses are very simple animals. They go out and they do their job. But when they don't do their job, it's time to look at the number one equalizer that's going to occur that makes that difficult, and that's pain. Pain comes from arthritis, injuries, you know, or sequela from something. So that can be, you know, at least diagnosed and or determined, and then you can determine, like, you know, is this career-ending or is this amount of deterioration too far to where this horse can't go out and function anymore? That's where you go to rely on experience, knowledge, and, you know, and the horse tells you pretty much, you know, that he's not going to do it anymore.
I appreciate it, and as a adjunct to a horse like Mills at age 11, still winning, there was the news in the last 2 weeks of Lemon Drop Kid, and I didn't even realize I hadn't done the math, but I didn't realize he had gotten to be 25. You know, here he is as a stallion, and he's being pensioned at 25. But it's quite something to make it to 24, and not have issues with motility and so forth. That's a ripe age to maintain a stallion career. 24.
Yes, most definitely. He was obviously really, really. I mean, Scotty Schulhofer trained him. He was a Senna King Mamba. That was a really nice horse. He ran on dirt, but his offspring, you know, from the King Mambo side, tended to show quite a bit of, you know, prowess on the turf. You know, he was a very, very versatile sire. I worked on a lot of his offspring and liked them. They're nice horses. They got the job done. I looked at one the other day when I was down at Palmetto's as a stakes filly, which I can't mention her name, but she, I worked on her for a trainer, and she's, you know, she's moved around for a few barns, has got down the claim level, but she's got black type. And ironically enough, she's a New York bred. So, you know, it turns out that, you know, you just you never know where you're going to come across them, but they're really, really nice horses. He was probably one of the best son of King Mambo, maybe, you know, the stud, but he was certainly he certainly accomplished, you know, and he won good races, you know, at three, won the I think it was the Belmont one, wasn't it?
Belmont Travers, you bet. You bet.
But, yeah, Belmont Travers, so you know, big time horse, probably Scotty's biggest 3 year old that he ever had, you know. I mean, he got a little more done. He won the Travers, won the Belmont, one of the classics. And, you know, says a lot about the horse, and he ended up going to stud at Lane's End and was, you know, did a great job. End of story. You know, it's glad to see him get tension, have a few nice years in the paddock, and hopefully maybe a decade. You never know. Maybe we'll get lucky. Keep him around longer.
When stallions reach their peak and start to lose the ability essentially to cover mares. I mean, is it strictly is it physical? Is it motility and viability of sperm? I mean, what typically ends a stallion's career?
Well, typically it's the physical, but you know. But most of the times, covering mares isn't that hard. They can accommodate for that, you know, with, you know, a few techniques, you know, different, like a mound for the stand if it's big mares, things like this. Or if they can't really mount and become more and more erect, because that's tough on their hind end and their back, because they've got to carry all their weight on their hind legs. But the usual, most typical reason is that they start impregnating mares, and their numbers go down tremendously. And then you do an evaluation and realize that they're just not producing viable spermatozoa anymore. And that's usually the most common way. But the physical can be just as taxing. But the more common way for most fans to end their careers is they stop impregnating mares, or they just don't get them pregnant anymore. So they evaluate semen and they're just not producing viable spermatozoa anymore.
Wanted to ask because it was a nice companion to the Mills victory yesterday at age 11. Steve, terrific start to the year, and I appreciate it. Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn, and of course Luberson.com and the alldayway.com, and ways to help your sport horse, your race horse, your trail horse, any kind of horse.
Your roping horse.
Ah, now you're talking. We talked a little bit of a rodeo with Clovis Crane earlier. We had Clovis to start the morning, and so I was thinking of you because of you got the rodeo action in common.
Yeah, well, I'm getting ready to crank up, and I'm breaking out with a new heeler this year. He's been really practicing hard, and he's a very, very accomplished calf roper, but now we got him healing, and he's doing really good. So we're going to go out and see if we can't qualify for a couple of big events. So we'll see what happens. I'll let you know.
Oh, I haven't talked to Lopresti. You've been practicing with him?
No, Charlie gave it up. He gave up the rope.
Did he really?
He does a lot of bird hunting. Yeah, he gave up the rope, but he does a lot of bird hunting now, so...
I'm glad I asked. Dr. Stephen Allday, everybody. You can follow Doc on Twitter, Four Legs Doc, and as I mentioned, Luberson.com and thealldayway.com. Steve, we'll talk soon. Thanks so much. Dr. Stephen Allday, the leading racetrack practitioner of his generation. Let's take a break, 15 minutes into hour three. And when we come back, Natalia Lynch is going to join us, and undoubtedly still aglow from her first career training victory. And it came in a stake, which is a neat trick. Natalia Lynch after this at the races.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them, is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing.